From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump is set to deliver his first State of the Union address tonight. He's expected to tout some of his victories during his first year in office, including the passage of the Republican tax bill. Gary Cohn, who directs the president's National Economic Council, spoke earlier today with CNBC about what else to expect from President Trump.
He'll also talk about infrastructure, which is the next leg of the stool in our economic agenda. We started with reg reform, we went on to tax reform, and then now we're on to infrastructure.
Joining us now is NPR congressional reporter Kelsey Snell. Hi, Kelsey.
Hi there.
And what more do we know, first of all, about the president's plan for infrastructure, which we may hear more about tonight?
Well, Gary Cohn also said that he expected it to be around $1.5 trillion investment. But beyond that, we don't really know much. We know what Trump said on the campaign trail, which is that they were talking about ideas of public-private partnerships. But that's a difficult sell in Congress. And so is the idea of spending over $1 trillion after doing big tax cuts. So this is we wait to see. But we haven't seen any real details that would constitute an actual plan.
What else are you expecting the president to touch on tonight?
Well, they have said that the White House has said that they expect the president to talk about victories from the past year, including tax reform. And we're expecting to hear something about his plan for handling the immigration debate that's going on in Congress. And that's something that a lot of lawmakers are really eager to hear about because they do need to deal with the issue of DACA, which is the protections for roughly 700,000 immigrants who are in the country illegally after being brought here as children. They need to deal with that before March 5th.
Right.
So Congress is quite eager to hear what the president has to say about his specific asks in that department.
I've heard that the tone from the president tonight is expected to mirror in some ways what he did last week in Davos, Switzerland, which was kind of a more muted President Trump.
Yeah, the expectation that we're hearing is that it'll be positive and it will be, he says it will be forward looking, but a lot of the previews that we're hearing are going to be a little bit backward looking. This does seem a little bit like a cross between the kind of campaign style rhetoric that we would normally hear from Trump and the very scripted teleprompter style Trump that we heard at last year's address to Congress, the version of the State of the Union that was not exactly a State of the Union.
Now, there are going to be special guests there tonight, but there are also going to be some people who are not going to the State of the Union. Who's not going to be there?
Right. A small number of Democrats, primarily those in the House, have said that they plan to sit this one out. The group is rather small, but it includes some big names like John Lewis, who is known as a huge hero of the civil rights movement. He says he will not be attending. Also not attending will be Maxine Waters, who came to prominence last year. She's been in Congress for quite some time, but she had a revival of attention when she got into a sparring match with Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin during a hearing last year. She will actually be delivering a Democratic response on BET instead.
Actually, there are going to be a number of Democratic responses tonight,
yes.
Right? The official one coming from Massachusetts Congressman Joe Kennedy, but there are others as well.
Yeah, there are five in total right now. There is the Joe Kennedy one, which will be a more of a mainstream response from the center of the Democratic Party. There will also be a Spanish language response, which, again, expects to be very similar in tone and feel to what Kennedy says. But then you're going to see these other responses that really break down into the messaging platforms and factions of the Democratic Party. There will be an address for progressives from Senator Bernie Sanders. There will be the Maxine Waters response that we discussed earlier. And there will be another one from former Congresswoman Donna Edwards for the Working Families Party.
And by the way, for people who are not familiar with Joe Kennedy, he is the grandson of the late Bobby Kennedy.
So, and he is a rising star in the Democratic Party, and he's somebody that they hope to build a lot of the future around.
This is a messy moment, and you've talked about the issue of DACA. The president is going to be speaking tonight when there could be a government shutdown again in just a matter of weeks.
Yeah, we are between a government shutdown and a budget fight that, while we do not at this point expect will lead to a government shutdown, it is not a particularly positive place for Republicans who on the Hill are trying to figure out whether or not they can run with this president or against him the 2018 midterms. So it's a very complicated and tumultuous moment for the president to be coming to Congress and speaking to them on their turf.
And by the way, we just heard yesterday that the chair of the House Appropriations Committee, Rodney Frelinghuysen, is going to be one of the Republicans who is not going to run again.
Right. There are a number of Republicans, particularly in the House, who have decided not to run again. Some of them are retiring chairs who are they're not going to have access to their chairmanship anymore. And they're choosing to leave the House rather than to lose that power. But it is a huge number of retirements among Republicans and primarily in districts that are very competitive. So it's a place where Democrats think they could pick up some control.
That's NPR congressional reporter Kelsey Snell. Kelsey, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, today, House Speaker Paul Ryan defended Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, who's increasingly under fire for his role overseeing the FBI's Russia investigation. At a news conference this morning, Ryan was asked about speculation that President Trump wants to fire Rosenstein from what Trump calls a witch hunt.
I think Rod Rosenstein's doing a fine job. I have no reason to see why he should do that. Rosenstein was hired after this last election.
But Ryan also indicated that he wants the eventual release of that memo critical of Rosenstein. Last night, Republicans on the House Intelligence Committee released the memo to the entire House and sent it on to the White House. It reportedly accuses Rosenstein of improperly getting a surveillance warrant on Trump campaign aide Carter Page. The Republicans also withheld a rebuttal memo from Democrats. They say the information in the Republican memo was cherry-picked. The Trump Justice Department does not want the memo made public, but President Trump is expected to go against that recommendation any day now. Ryan Lucas covers the Justice Department for NPR. Briefly, Ryan, why was Carter Page even under suspicion?
Well, Carter Page was under suspicion because of a trip that he made to Moscow in the summer of 2016 during the presidential campaign, and contacts that he had with Russian officials at the time, as well as kind of interactions that he had with Russians going back for a while. One thing that came up in reporting on Carter Page over the past year is that he had an interaction with a man who turned out to be a Russian spy in New York. Page was unaware of the man's intelligence role, but he's certainly been of interest and on the FBI's radar because of these sorts of interactions for quite some time.
Well, so the controversy today has to do with FBI officials going to a FISA court to get a warrant to surveil Carter. The New York Times reporting that Republicans are saying in this memo that the request was based on the Christopher Steele dossier. This was the former British spy who put together intel. He became alarmed at what he called Russian connections. What are Republicans saying about what they say is the use of that dossier to get the FISA warrant?
Well, this has been one of the Republican kind of talking points for several weeks, if not months now, that this allegation that the FBI's investigation of possible coordination between the Trump campaign and Russia is largely based on this dossier. And the dossier, of course, was funded by first by conservative donors, but then later by the DNC and the Hillary Clinton campaign. So they say that if it was funded by Democrats, then that basically undermines the whole rationale for having this investigation.
Because that means that the whole FISA warrant request was backed and financed by Democrats. I mean, that's what they're implying.
Well, that it provides
the
foundation for it.
Right.
Yeah, the information.
Right. Well, and as you said, it was originally funded by the Washington Free Beacon, the conservative group. They were against Trump, the candidate. They were looking for intelligence on him, very common. And then when he became the front runner, they backed out. The Democrats came in, again, very common. Well, the Times is reporting today that the Republican memo also left out that the dossier wasn't even used by the judge in the FISA court. It didn't meet the standard to get a warrant. Other intelligence was used. What do you make of that?
Well, the fact is that to get a FISA warrant to conduct surveillance inside the U.S., that would be for national security purposes, you have to get court approval from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. It's not easy to do, is what current and former officials say. You have to convince a judge that there's probable cause that an individual is an agent of a foreign power. And while they normally do get approved these warrants, there's often a back and forth with investigators and prosecutors, and the applications are sometimes modified. So they say it's a very high bar that the applications for these are sometimes 50, 60, 70 pages. It's not like you just show up at the court and say, we'd like to survey this person, and the court rubber stamps it.
Yeah. And by the way, this memo was written by Intelligence Committee Chair Devin Nunes, who last year, we remember the big splash, the big headline when he said his sources told him that the Trump campaign was improperly surveilled, same claim in this memo. His sources turned out to be White House officials. Where do you think this is going? Rosenstein is the only Justice Department official who can fire Special Counsel Bob Mueller. Some are seeing this as this memo is undercutting him. Where does this go?
Well, there are a couple of theories on this. The theory that this is being used as a pretext to possibly remove Rosenstein and put in somebody for the president to then be able to put in somebody who would get rid of Special Counsel Robert Mueller. We don't know that at this point. There's no hard evidence that that is indeed what is going on here. But certainly the whole kind of cloud over Rosenstein right now is part of a broader – what Democrats would say is a broader Republican effort to try to undermine confidence in the DOJ, the FBI, as well as kind of any conclusions that Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation may come to.
Yeah, and we wait to see if/when President Trump will make this Republican memo public. Ryan Lucas covers the Justice Department for NPR. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
One of the things President Trump is likely to talk about tonight in his State of the Union address is the Middle East. His controversial decision to move the U.S. Embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem has worried many experts who believe it'll make a peace deal between Israelis and Palestinians much more difficult. Joining us now is George Mitchell, a longtime Democratic senator and former Senate Majority Leader. He was also special envoy to Northern Ireland under President Clinton and to the Middle East under President Obama. Senator Mitchell, thanks for joining us. And what do you think about that decision by the president to move the embassy?
There's no doubt about the fact that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel and will be the capital of Israel. The only issue is whether there will ever be a Palestinian capital in East Jerusalem as the capital of an independent Palestinian state. I think the president's action in moving the embassy was premature and unwise because it undermined the very policy which the president himself has been pursuing, consistent with American policy over many decades, and that is to achieve a solution. The only solution I think possible is that of two independent states, but to achieve a solution through negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians. They themselves must sit down, negotiate, and decide their future. And the decision by the president to move the embassy has made getting negotiations much more difficult, and if we ever do get into negotiations, made getting a satisfactory result even more difficult than that.
But not impossible.
Well, nothing's impossible in the world. Times and circumstances change, and certainly there's dramatic change in the Middle East. It's much different from when I was there on my last tour of duty as President Obama's special envoy, and that creates both dangers and opportunities. And I hope very much that the parties will get together, will negotiate, because it really is in the interest of both societies. Israel has a very successful state, but the people of Israel don't have security, reasonable and sustainable security. They live in constant fear and anxiety of attack. The Palestinians don't have a state. They want one. And as President Bush told them in a very good speech he made in January of 2008 in Jerusalem to both Palestinian and Israeli leaders, the Israelis are not going to get security until the Palestinians get a state. And the Palestinians are not going to get a state until the people of Israel have reasonable and sustainable security. So each should be vested in the other's interest. And I think sooner or later, both societies are going to come to that realization and move forward.
Let's listen to some of President Trump speaking at the World Economic Forum in Davos. And he accused the Palestinians of disrespecting the U.S. by refusing to meet with Vice President Pence on his recent visit to the Middle East. And the president threatened to withhold more aid to the Palestinians. Here he is.
And we give them hundreds of millions of dollars in aid and support, tremendous numbers, numbers that nobody understands. That money is on the table, and that money is not going to them unless they sit down and negotiate peace.
George Mitchell, what do you think of that?
I don't think it'll work. In both my tours of duty in the Middle East, both sides offered that as the way to solve the problem. the Palestinians and all of the Arabs said, oh, the Israelis are dependent upon you. If you just cut off their funding, they'll do whatever you want. And the Israelis said, the Palestinians are dependent upon you. If you just cut off their funding, they'll do what you want. I don't believe it will work in either case. Both are proud people. They have their own sense of identity and mission. And I think the way to get them to the negotiation is to create incentives, not through threats and cutting off aid. And might I point out, the principal victims of a cutoff of aid will, of course, be Palestinians. There'll be tremendous hunger, suffering among Palestinians over a long period of time. But a secondary effect will be tremendously adverse to Israel. A complete cutoff of assistance to the Palestinians means that effectively that burden will fall on the Israelis, which they really don't need or want. And so I think it's an unwise strategy. Maybe it'll work. The Palestinians are obviously in a very desperate condition. But I've never believed that this kind of threat or cutoff, particularly to people who we have heretofore regarded as people that we support in their aspiration, that I think does remain American policy. I just don't think those kinds of tactics work. Maybe they will. We'll have to see down the road.
Well, why do you think President Trump is willing to take that risk?
I don't think he sees it as a risk. I think that
You think he thinks he'll get everything he wants?
I have no way of knowing that. You'd have to ask him that. But, you know, the principal beneficiaries of the president's decision were those both among Palestinians and Israelis who don't favor a two-state solution. The right wing in Israel, well represented in the current government, openly and aggressively advocates there never being a Palestinian state on the West Bank. And many of them advocate the complete annexation of all of the West Bank by Israel. So they're very pleased and emboldened by the president's statement. On the Palestinian side, they're divided too. Those who support the Palestinian Authority and President Abbas oppose violence, recognize Israel, want to reach an agreement. The others, Hamas, led by Hamas, are opposed to Israel's existence, want to use violence, and they're very emboldened by this. So what it has done is emboldened the groups on both sides who are opposed to any two-state solution. And I think the only possible solution to end the conflict is through two states. So I think it's a setback, and a setback for American policy. This has been American policy for quite a long time.
Do you think the U.S. has lost credibility as a party that could possibly negotiate peace in the Middle East?
Well, that's certainly true among the Palestinians, the Arabs, and the broader Muslim community. Keep in mind that now about 1 out of 5 persons on earth is Muslim, and by the year 2050, it'll be 1 out of 3.
Right.
There'll then be about 3.5 billion Muslims in the world, and I think clearly we've lost ground there. But I don't think that's irretrievable. I think they all know and recognize that there cannot be an agreement without the active support and participation of the United States government, because there is no other entity, government or otherwise, that can create the conditions and do what's necessary to keep compliance with any agreement.
As we mentioned, you also helped negotiate the peace accord in Northern Ireland. I want to ask you about that. As the UK breaks away from the European Union, there is concern now about what will happen to the now open border between Ireland's north and south. Are you concerned that Brexit could undermine peace in Ireland?
Yes, I am. I think the damage goes far beyond that, though. Brexit was a decision democratically taken by free people in a democratic society and must be respected for that reason. But my own view and that of many others, that it's a profound mistake. The potential for disrupting the peace process in Northern Ireland exists if there is a remilitarization of the border and the ease with which people now move back and forth, which has been so important in reducing stereotypes and demonization and encouraging trade and movement of people across the border, if that ends. But the damage goes far beyond that. The economy of the Republic of Ireland is deeply integrated into that of the United Kingdom. And if Ireland remains part of the European Union and they don't get a special provision in the treaty between the UK and the European countries, the Irish economy would be damaged, I think, more than that of the United Kingdom. And that of the United Kingdom, I think, is also going to be damaged, depending on the nature of the agreement that occurs. So I hope very much that both the UK government and the European Union governments will not try to refight the battle of Brexit. That was decided by the people of the United Kingdom, but try to figure out a way to maintain some status for the UK in terms of trade, movement of people that will minimize the adverse effects both to the UK, which includes Northern Ireland, and to the Republic of Ireland itself.
I want to ask you one more question. You were the Senate Majority Leader as a Democrat. Do you think that the future of the Democratic Party should be on the left side or more as a centrist party? Because as you know, there's a major debate going on in the party right now about where to go forward.
I'm not a labels guy. I like to deal with issues. I think the Democratic Party has a very strong and bright future if we concentrate on those principles, those policies, and those actions which created such strong support for Democrats over the past century. And that is concentrating on economic growth, job creation, working men and women, many of whom feel we have forgotten them. And that's got to be the emphasis. I believe this to the bottom of my heart, that the single most important agency in United States history in opening up doors of opportunity, reducing, breaking down barriers to people moving ahead, getting education and skills, has been the Democratic Party and the policies that it has pursued. And we've got to get back to that kind of basic. And when we do that, we will prevail in elections and be doing the right thing for the American people.
Are you running in 2020?
No, thanks very much for asking.
That's George Mitchell, former U.S. Senator, Senate Majority Leader, and Special Envoy to Northern Ireland under President Clinton and to the Middle East under President Obama. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Love trivia, puzzles, nerdy games, and humor? What about interviews with actors, musicians, and people from all walks of life? Yeah? Then join me, Ophira Eisenberg, host of NPR's Ask Me Another, every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Tomorrow morning, many Americans will have good reason to wake up early. Not only will there be a blue moon and a supermoon, but North America will also witness its first total lunar eclipse in more than 2 years. Kelly Beatty is senior editor at Sky and Telescope. He joins us by Skype. Hi, Kelly.
Hello, Jeremy.
And what do you call this? Do you call it a blood moon or a supermoon or a blue moon? What?
Boy, you know, those are all pretty colorful terms. Blood moon is what we call a total lunar eclipse because when the moon is in the Earth's shadow, it doesn't go completely dark. There's a little bit of light leaking around the edge of the Earth through its atmosphere, and that tends to color the moon dark red or coppery, and that's where the blood moon aspect comes from. So as you mentioned, this is the first one of these we've had for like 2.5 years. We're going through withdrawal here, and being able to see the moon in totality is a good thing.
And by the way, a blue moon is just the second full moon of the month. It's not as impressive as a blood moon.
Well, that's right. It's a different phenomenon, right? And this full moon's in 1 month, the second one being called a blue moon, is actually a historical accident, believe it or not. Sky and Telescope wrote an article about this in 1946, and we misinterpreted what had been traditional sources like the Maine Farmer's Almanac. But it's, you know, two full moons in a month is what it is now, and we're sort of rolling with that.
And let's hit on the last part of it, which is it's a supermoon, which means it's a full moon at the closest distance to the Earth. So it'll be pretty big in the sky.
It is super in that sense. It's the moon is closest to Earth. But you know what? It's not so super, really. When it gets close like this, it's 6% closer than average. And I'll challenge you or anybody to go out and actually see that there's a difference. I and other stargazers that go out and do this on a regular basis, boy, I have a hard time telling that the full moon is any closer than a normal one.
So when and where will the best view of this be?
This is going to be an event that's visible before dawn. And the farther out west you are, the better off you'll be. On the Pacific coast, for example, the middle of the eclipse, when the moon is deep in totality, happens at 5:30 a.m. And that's still well before the sun comes up and the moon sets in the west. On the east coast, and the farther east you get, it gets a little dicier. For example, we won't get to see any of totality because the moon will have set long before the eclipse is really getting underway. So the farther west you are, the better your chances of seeing the whole thing.
How rare is it for these three celestial events to all happen at the same time?
You know, the supermoon total eclipse is not that rare. The last one we had in 2015 was, in fact, when the moon was close to us, at what we call that perigee. And the next one that we'll see here in the U.S., which is about this time next year, will likewise be at perigee. The aspect that it's, you know, a second full moon of the month, that's a little rare. The last time that happened anywhere in the world was December of 1982. So, you know, every 35 years or so, we get one of these.
And what about the next solar eclipse, Kelly? When do we get another one of those?
Oh, aren't we all looking forward to that? Well, the next one anywhere in the world will be in 2019, July 2nd. It's a Tuesday, and that will be visible on land from Chile and Argentina in South America. I'm going to be down there, and a lot of people will be. The next one in the U.S. is 2024.
That's Kelly Beatty, senior editor at Sky and Telescope. Kelly, thanks as always.
A pleasure, Jeremy.
Last week, we heard from a volunteer with the group No More Deaths. They provide water and supplies for people making the dangerous and illegal desert crossing into the U.S. along the border with Mexico. No More Deaths had released a report claiming Border Patrol agents routinely sabotage what the volunteers call humanitarian efforts and some agents called aiding illegal crossings. And the group also showed videos of border agents kicking over water jugs left in the desert by volunteers or defiantly pouring them out as the volunteers filmed. Well, today we speak with Stephen Passman. He's acting special operations supervisor in the Border Patrol's Tucson sector. He's been a field agent. Agent Passman, Steve, what did you think when you saw the videos? And I guess I should ask, have you ever done that?
No, I'll have to be honest with you. I've never done that. You know, we were all appalled at it.
Yeah.
The Tucson sector does not instruct any of our agents to remove, destroy, or mess with any items out there. We don't condone those actions. We have a common goal with these non-governmental organizations, and I would love to expand on that.
Well, we do want to hear about that, but as you know, members of the volunteer group No More Deaths say it does happen a lot. Those videos were pretty damning. They say it's not just bad apples. You're saying it is?
I'm saying that's not the normal here.
Yeah.
Not the norm. If any accusations are brought forward or complaints in this manner, the Tucson sector is going to thoroughly look into this and hold those agents that are responsible accountable.
So what happened to the agents in the videos?
On those videos, you know, what I can say is if I believe is the agent, one of the agents was disciplined. I believe there was a 3-day suspension. One of the agents has retired, and I believe on one of those other videos, the agent wasn't identified. But what I will tell you, you know, speaking of the videos, there is a portion on there where that is a concern to really us is the 2017 videos. You know, we found out just like everybody else found out when the videos came out. What's surprising to us is really that, you know, we've met with this organization several times over the years, really. On different topics, different issues, and unfortunately, that was never brought to our attention, and that's a concern because you know here we're looking at almost a year later, and we're just seeing this now. It makes it very difficult to try to identify you know who that agent may have been if it was an agent, mm-hmm. and try to find out what area that was, and it makes it difficult to try to pinpoint who that person was and hold that person accountable.
Well, so Alicia Dinsmore, a volunteer with the group No More Deaths, a woman we spoke with last week. She said it was more than kicking over water jugs. She said volunteers are harassed. There's threats of detention. Their vehicles are being run off the road by Border Patrol agents. Border Patrol agents in the field surveil and follow them. You're saying you're just doing your job, which is finding out who it is that's come across and might be getting help from these aid agencies. And I heard you say you want to work with the agencies, how would you work with No More Deaths?
Well, you know, we have different programs where we've worked with other organizations. We have our messaging with our rescue beacons. I'm not sure if you're familiar with our rescue beacons.
No, tell me about them.
Sure. We have 34 rescue beacons deployed between Nogales, Arizona, and Naho, Arizona, in that area. And the reason being is that it's the most desolate, harsh area of our desert here. A lot of smugglers are taking these folks out into these areas that are very dangerous. And they're lying to them, telling them, in essence, that it's only going to be a short walk or maybe a half day. And it's see those lights ahead, that's Phoenix. And not being not given the realities of the dangers out there and taking them onto the harsh environment. So we have these rescue beacons out there where we've developed these flyers that we pass out that's in Spanish. And it's visual pictorials there that they can see that there's no water, there's few resources, no medical. And in some areas, there's no cell phone signal. We want people to be able to identify what a rescue beacon is. It's a life-saving tool that we use out there. And we've, you know, just last year, the last fiscal year, Tucson sector alone was responsible for saving over 750 individuals here in our sector.
Because the beacon does what? They can turn it on when they're lost or starting to die for lack of water? I mean, what do they do with it?
Yes, the rescue beacon is about 30 feet high. It's similar to the, I guess, the phone towers you would find on the side of a highway. Mm. And actually, seven of these rescue beacons have satellite phones on them because there is no cell phone signal out there. And it has this high-intensity blue light that's visible both during the day, during the night. It has reflective mirrors. So we want to bring attention to them so that when people get there, they'll see the box that's on there. The instructions are written in English, Spanish, and the Tohoto O'odham language because a lot of them are on the tribal land there. And it has a pictorial guide there where it shows you the picture that if you press the button, you sit and wait, and somebody will come to render assistance.
But that somebody would be an agent who would also arrest them, presumably.
That is correct. That is correct. I won't lie to you about that. But the important thing to notice here or to focus on really is that you're taking that individual who's in distress out of that harmful environment, provide water. If they need further medical attention, they will get them that medical attention. If we have to call 911, we'll call 911. We'll get them there. And it's happened many, many, many times.
Yeah. Well, talk about some of the other challenges that Border Patrol agents face. We've heard you have to kind of make friends with the landowners because smugglers might be offering them money to be lookouts. What are some of the other things we might not think of?
Well, you know what the challenges are, you know, ensuring the community understands what our mission is. And also, you know, it's not just enforcement, but you have to remember the men and women that work out here in the Border Patrol, you know, they have to wear this dual hat. We go out there in an enforcement role, yes, day after day. But when you encounter somebody in the desert that really is in harm's way or has been injured, just needs water, wants to give up, that's when you put on that other hat. And really, it's the humanitarian role we play because, you know, many times agents have given their lunch, given their water, getting them out of that environment. I understand the need to come into the United States. One of the things we also do is the messaging is folks that come come at a different time frames, and if you see the borders change drastically over the years, it's a hot topic now. And it's important for us to inform folks of how the borders change because there's more technology now, more manpower, more infrastructure. So the chances of being detained or apprehended are greater than ever before. And we want folks to know that because if they're going to come, we want them to come legally. But if they're going to come illegally, then please at least come better informed. And that's a lot of the messaging we do so that they can really think about what their decision is going to be and not put their hands or their lives in the hands of a smuggler who's going to not really care for them.
Well, that's another complaint, though, of the volunteers that the border has changed. And one of the ways it's changed is it's funneling people coming across illegally into more dangerous areas.
Well, you have to understand our enforcement stance here is we have to enforce the borders. The smugglers are the ones that are taking these folks out into these extreme desolate areas. And unfortunately, they're lying to them. They're leaving them out there. And you know, if they start falling behind, they start yelling at them. They'll start beating them and they'll leave them behind.
Yeah.
And if you're a female, there's a risk that, you know, you could be raped. And those are the realities that we want folks to understand and know before coming.
Because you're the people that find them.
Yes.
Which can't be I mean, you have to be pretty hard-hearted. I mean, there's young kids on occasion, as you say, women who've been raped. You talked about putting on your other hat. That's got to be tough.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, the Tucson sector began training their own EMTs in 2002. You know, right now we have over 200 EMTs, the emergency medical technicians, just here in the Tucson sector alone. You know, we have 10 paramedics. We have our search, trauma, and rescue team here. So we had to take a stance, a proactive stance, to train our agents because we're going to be the first ones to respond. But what I will say is, if anything, if anybody finds themselves in distress, the very first thing you need to do is call 911, because that's we're going to radio also to call 911 if we find somebody in distress and that level of care needs to be advanced or pushed higher. We know we're going to need to seek further medical treatment for these individuals.
That's Stephen Passmant, acting Special Operations Supervisor in the Border Patrol's Tucson sector. Agent Passmant, Steve, thank you.
Hey, thank you. I just want to say, you know, I welcome and encourage the communication and cooperation for us, the Tucson sector, with any agency or organization to better serve and protect those within the nation's borders. So, and I encourage folks to reach out to local stations if they have questions. We want to build bonds here. And the only way to do that is really to call, develop that dialogue. So I encourage that.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you.
The Trump administration says it has no plans to build a national 5G wireless network. The White House is pushing back after a memo was published by the news site Axios that showed there is talk in the White House of building a 5G network. Here to explain is our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Tony Rahm is senior editor of policy and politics for Recode. He joins us now. Hi, Tony.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. And start with, what is 5G?
Yeah, that's the important question to start with here. 5G is this next generation of wireless. And if you talk to companies like AT&T and Verizon, major carriers here in the United States, they say it could deliver speeds up to 10 times faster what most Americans get on their smartphones right now. But it's about more than just downloading movies and music faster than you currently do. You know, for a world of self-driving cars and package-delivering drones to ever come to fruition, those technologies have to have access to a fast, reliable network. And those are the sorts of things that 5G could do here in the United States in the near future.
Is there any 5G in the United States yet?
Well, companies are certainly testing it, but the reality is that there won't be any sort of deployment until 2020. We're still working through the standards as to how this is going to look. And remember, for 5G to work in some cases, you need much more physical infrastructure, small boxes scattered throughout cities, for example, that take the place of towers that you might see along the sides of the road. You know, these things have to be closer together. Money has to be spent. Things have to be deployed for there to be a true 5G network here in the United States.
So maybe not surprising that people in the White House were thinking about, well, maybe we should build one big national 5G network. What did that original memo say?
Yeah, the memo that was put forward by a staff member on the National Security Council, which is a part of the White House that advises the president on U.S. and foreign matters, contemplated a slice of the spectrum put aside for a 5G network that could potentially be owned by the U.S. government. That would be a dramatic departure from current policy, seeing as the FCC licenses those wireless airwaves to carriers like AT&T and Verizon. And the Trump administration contemplated this because it was concerned about China. There was a fear that Chinese manufacturers, companies like Huawei, for instance, might try to set up shop here in the United States and put forward the equipment that would be used in a 5G network. And folks in the Trump administration believe that companies like Huawei have too close ties to the Chinese government. There's always been this fear that there are security risks in having the Chinese manufacturer here in the United States. So that's what motivated the NSC memo. But when I talk to sources, they say this was not a done deal. It was an idea. There's no imminent push for a 5G network owned by the government right now.
Is it still an idea, though?
Well, plenty of folks who actually could turn this idea into policy are not on board with it. That includes the Federal Communications Commission, where Chairman Ajit Pai pretty vehemently opposed it in a statement yesterday. Even Republicans on Capitol Hill, who could write a law setting aside that spectrum for a national 5G network, you know, they say the same thing. They don't like the idea of nationalizing U.S. airwaves. So for the moment, there's no Republican support for it. But when you talk to the White House, you speak to Sarah Huckabee Sanders and some other press folks there, they say they haven't decided yet. All options are still on the table.
And the industry, by the way, the telecom industry is against this.
Absolutely hate it. They want that airwaves for themselves. They want to be the ones that put forward these wireless networks. They want to have the money and the revenue that's associated with that.
So with or without federal involvement, how long is it going to be before people in the U.S. start to get 5G?
We're talking about years. We're still in the process of setting the standards for what 5G looks like. And I think everyone looks at 2020 as the year where we could really see companies start to deploy this stuff. But there's a lot of work still to be done and a lot of investment still that has to be made in the United States for a 5G network to appear in your smartphone.
And what about other countries, Tony? How does this technology compare around the world? I know that many other countries have been working on this and testing it.
Yeah, we're talking about millions and billions of dollars that have been invested everywhere from the European Union to Beijing, China, because all countries want to take advantage of this technology. It's not just the United States that wants faster streaming speeds and self-driving cars and package delivery drones. And for the country that can really come first here, there's a potential for economic benefit because companies want to set up shop and deploy their technologies in a place where there's a fast, reliable, high-speed internet service like 5G. So there's certainly a race that's on.
Tony, as somebody who covers tech in Washington, D.C., what are you going to be watching for tonight in the State of the Union address? What might President Trump talk about? Probably not 5G, I'm guessing, but maybe he will mention it.
Who knows? Maybe we'll get the first mention of 5G in a State of the Union address. I think compared to previous years, we probably won't see a lot from this president on specific tech issues. Former President Barack Obama talked a lot about them and used the State of the Union address as a vehicle to announce things on areas like broadband and cybersecurity. But the Trump administration hasn't sent signals that it's looking to do things. But Silicon Valley is keeping an eye on this speech because they really want to hear what this president has to say on infrastructure reform and on immigration. And with respect to immigration in particular, many in the tech industry still want an answer from Congress and the White House on the future of DACA. That's the program that protects more than 800,000 Dreamers brought here as children, many of which work in Silicon Valley.
That's Tony Rahm, senior editor of Policy and Politics for Recode. Tony, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Robin, I can't wait for 5G because my phone, it seems like, just keeps getting slower.
Well,
day by day, it gets slower and slower.
That could be that you are moving fast.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.